From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, presidential politics. We talked to Donna Brazil. She was Al Gore's campaign manager during the 2000 presidential race. After the Florida recount, she became the first chair of the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Institute. She's written a new memoir called Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. Also, we talk with playwright, poet, and actor Sarah Jones about her critically acclaimed one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congressional leaders are moving to limit President Bush's flexibility in spending funds on the military operations in Iraq, NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The House Appropriations Committee released a long list of figures showing the breakdown of how lawmakers plan to direct the president in spending further Iraq funds. It includes billions for military pay and operation and maintenance, as well as specific line items for new body armor, combat gear, ammunition, and more. Of the total request, worth $25 billion, the president would have control over just $1 billion. He would also have the authority to shift around another $2 billion in the budget with the approval of the Congressional Defense Committees. The top senator in charge of appropriations said he also plans to limit significantly how much control President Bush has over the Iraq funds. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
U.S. troops continue to clash with Shiite militants in the Iraqi city of Kufa, nearly a week after the militants' leader promised to cease fire. U.S. military officials say at least 4 Iraqis have been killed and 36 wounded. Meanwhile, at least 5 people were killed and more than 30 wounded by a car bomb in northern Baghdad. The American Civil Liberties Union is suing several government agencies, charging they violated federal law by refusing to disclose information about prisoner abuse in Iraq. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and other organizations say they filed a Freedom of Information Act request last October asking the government for any documents related to the abuse of prisoners. The request specifically targeted detainees held outside the U.S. and also asked about policies for handing prisoners to other countries known to use torture. At the time, the Departments of Justice, Defense, Homeland Security, and other agencies all refused to respond quickly to those requests, saying there were no extenuating circumstances, such as a threat to the life of an individual. The suit charges the government basically lied and cites the numerous reports of wide-scale abuse that have come out in recent weeks as proof. The goal is complete disclosure of any abuse records. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Mutinous Congolese troops have seized control of a key town on the Rwandan border in a move that threatens the Central African nation's recovery from civil war. A former rebel general told reporters that he is now in charge of the town of Bukavu. Congo President Joseph Kabila blamed Rwanda for helping the mutineers and said Bukavu has been occupied by Rwandan troops. During the chaos, aid officials say civilians looted 2 barges and a warehouse owned by the UN World Food Program. In stocks, the Dow gained 60 to close at 10,263. The Nasdaq lost 2 to 1989. This is NPR News. Democrats in the U.S. House are calling for a special counsel to investigate Vice President Dick Cheney's involvement in the award of a no-bid government contract to his former employer, Halliburton Company. The Congress members want an explanation for a newly released Army email that said Cheney's office coordinated action on a multi-billion-dollar contract in Iraq for the company where Cheney was chief executive officer for 5 years. Time magazine first reported on the email, which was sent by an official in the Army Corps of Engineers in March of last year. A consumer group says the Department of Veterans Affairs gets a better deal on prescription drugs than individuals can get with the new Medicare drug discount card. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
Families USA is calling for Medicare to negotiate with drug manufacturers and get lower prices like the Department of Veterans Affairs gets. The group analyzed the VA's cost and discount cardholders' costs for the top 20 brand-name drugs. With a Medicare discount card, people pay 7% to 221% more. But the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association says if Medicare cardholders got a VA-type discount, drug companies would spend less on research or raise prices for other people. Congressional Republicans point out that the VA plan isn't better because it only covers certain drugs, but Families USA counters that the discount cards also don't cover every drug. Joanne Solberner, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities in Laredo, Texas, say two stolen propane trucks have been recovered. A gas company in San Antonio reported that the trucks were stolen over the weekend, raising fears that terrorists might have taken them for use in an attack. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop features an assortment of clothing, mugs, and other NPR gear selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Donna Brazile was Al Gore's campaign manager in 2000 when he ran against then-Governor George Bush. Brazile was the first African-American woman to manage a presidential campaign. She previously worked in the campaigns of Michael Dukakis, Walter Mondale, and Jesse Jackson. After the Florida recount, she became the first chair of the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Institute. In her new memoir, Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, she writes about her life as a political organizer and how she got to where she is. She was born in the Charity Hospital in New Orleans. Her father was a janitor, her mother a maid. I asked her about what Al Gore has been saying lately. He's described the Bush-Cheney administration as incompetent and has called for the resignations of several members of the administration, including Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. Brazile told me that she thinks Al Gore is doing the right thing by being so outspoken, but some political observers say Gore might actually be hurting John Kerry by rallying some Democratic voters around views too far to the left for Kerry. She disagrees.
Gore is doing his best to, I believe, just speak out on important issues of the day and not really try to follow all of the dictates of the Democratic Party, the Kerry campaign. He is right to do it. He's helping MoveOn.org. He's helping the PAC to raise money, and he's helping to change the political flavor this season. And it's a good thing that Al Gore is out there, rallying Democrats, rallying progressives, and trying to keep the party unified. In 2000, we had a problem. Ralph Nader was able to rally progressives and some liberals and siphon votes from Al Gore. So the fact that Al Gore is out there trying to keep people inside the party, keep people behind John Kerry, that's a good thing for John Kerry and the Democratic Party.
What do you think is going to happen with Nader? Do you think he's going to stay in the race, and do you think it will hurt Kerry if he does?
Well, Ralph Nader is quite a politician. He said he's not going to hurt the Democrats this time. In fact, he believes he's going to siphon votes from George Bush. Ha ha. Nader's not as strong as he was in 2000 when we first started polling. Ralph Nader was, capturing over 15% of the vote. Today, he's capturing less than 5%. If we can keep Ralph Nader to 2 or 3% in some of these battleground states, he's not going to be a factor in 2004.
John Kerry has been criticized for not being warm enough, for not rating high enough in likability, similar to the criticisms that Al Gore got when he was running for president. How do you react to that? I mean, is there a part of you that wants to say, grow up, this isn't a popularity contest, we're talking about the president?
Well, people want to bond with their president. They want to get to know their president. They want to feel the person. So there's some truth to some of the rumors that you hear that John Kerry at times seems so thoughtful, so distant. Kerry is one of those kind of thoughtful, analytical, reason. Well, he's the kind of politician that really thinks before he speaks. And so it's normal for him to come across as a senator. But you know what? He's running for president. He's having fun. He's smiling more. He's warming up to large crowds. And just give John Kerry, I tell people, give him some time to emerge as this national leader. Remember, this is his first run for president. He hasn't done it before, and I'm sure that over the course of the next couple of months, people will find that John Kerry is not only a likable guy, but he's quite amusing when you really get to know him. He cracks you up. He really makes you laugh. At the same time, he's so serious that you want to say to him, okay, thank you so much. Let's have some fun now.
In your book, you write about how the worst days of your professional career were during and just after the recount in 2000. There seemed to be some kind of agreement among Democrats high up in the party to put that behind them after it was over. I want to quote something that Al Gore recently said at one of his MoveOn.org speeches. He said, "In December of 2000, even though I strongly disagreed with the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to order a halt to the counting of legally cast ballots, I saw it as my duty to reaffirm my own strong belief that we are a nation of laws. I not only accept the decision, but do what I could to prevent the efforts to delegitimize George Bush as he took the oath of office as president. I did not at that moment imagine that Bush would, in the presidency that ensued, demonstrate utter contempt for the rule of law and work at every turn to frustrate accountability." I'm wondering if you're thinking now that the issue of the 2000 recount should be addressed in the presidential campaign, or if you would like to see Democrats continue to more or less put that behind them.
Well, as a matter of public policy, it's difficult to put an election behind you when the officials who are in charge of cleaning up the problems are still off duty. It's difficult to put the election behind you when the problems that plagued you in 2000 may come back to haunt you in 2004. It's difficult, in my judgment, to even talk about, wrapping your arms around this election without seeing what we can do to make this democracy the very best and remove the flaws. But at that moment when Gore threw in the towel, I was not pleased with the decision to throw in the towel, because the way in which it came about, the Supreme Court decision, they used Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, the 15th Amendment, the 14th, the Equal Protection. And that was like laughing on the graves of people who died for the right to vote. And so I'm not going to put this one behind me until I see America, this country do a better job in funding our election reforms and giving citizens the tool they need to navigate the political process.
You overheard Al Gore's end of the phone conversation when he called George W. Bush and on the night of the election and told him that he had decided not to concede because the race was so close. What do you remember hearing Al Gore say?
I was so happy with Al Gore. You know, Al Gore is one of these people, I guess I have this relationship with other politicians, but, you know, at times Gore was just my champion. I could just close my eyes and say, "You go get him. Just go get him. I got your back." But when he looked at the results and thought it was over with, he went up to the ninth floor and said, "I got to go talk to Tip," and he reached out to Daley to get the number of George Bush to call the then-Governor Bush. And I said, "Whoa, never surrender." I didn't feel it. I didn't feel like we lost. And Gore came back. We went to the War Memorial. We got up to the second floor, but Michael Feldman, one of the staffers, had gotten a call from another staff person, Michael Hooley, and said, "Wait a minute. Don't call anybody because there's a recount." And I was so happy. I was so overjoyed. Gore called then-Governor Bush, and apparently then-Governor Bush said something to the fact, "Well, my brother told me we won." And Gore said, "Well, all due respect to your brother." I mean, Gore got a little attitude, a little groove, and I was like, "You go, you go. You just smack him." That's in the book. I had to talk about that because I was so proud of him. Joe Lieberman, who at the time I was, you know, sort of hanging on to Joe Lieberman because God knows we felt so bad about what was happening in Florida, Lieberman just leaped to his feet and Gore was just really giving it back to then-Governor Bush. That was one of my finest moments, listening to that conversation.
When did you first realize that there were voting problems in Florida?
Around 6:30 that morning. It was amazing. We were in Tampa. We started off, we flew in from Flint. And we had a huge rally in South Beach with Robert De Niro and Stevie Wonder and Babyface and Jessica Lange, and it was huge. We went up to Tampa for one last rally, and at 6:30, I started making phone calls. On election day, I normally spend hours on drive time radio trying to capture those last minute voters, like, "Please go and vote before you go to work." And I had Gore primed up to do an interview, and I was talking to the producer, Stacey WTMP in Tampa, and she said, do you know about all of the ballots that are being thrown out? I said, why? And she said, because apparently their signature was in the wrong place, or they didn't have authorization or notary signatures. And I said, well, the law doesn't require that. So I called Athenia Joyner, who's a state representative in Tampa, and I said, hey, you got problems in your backyard? She said, yeah, my dad ballot got thrown out. I'm like, oh, okay. So I didn't pay any mind. Called down to Bishop Curry in Miami. He had the same problems with precincts in predominantly Haitian areas not opening, some precincts in the predominantly black area having problems. Then I heard from Lieberman, and he talked about some of the problems in West Palm Beach. I still didn't think nothing of it. When we got to Nashville, all hell broke loose. I just started hearing all these, you know, bad stories from all over the country. And I finally got a call from my sister, Dimitri, who lived in Seminole County at the time, and she said, how many IDs do I need to vote? I'll never forget that as long as I live. I said, one. And she said, no. I said, Dimitri, one. I said, you voted in September. She said, yes, but now they want more IDs. So she had a voter registration card, a driver's license. She finally produced a utility bill, and somehow they allowed her to vote. Now, that day was a tough day. I heard people in Virginia, people in Michigan. And finally, about 1 o'clock, I was full. I was just, you know, just up to my eyeballs and all of the stories. And I wrote in a book where I called Eric Holder. He was number two at the Justice Department. And I appealed to Eric. I said, look, I know I haven't checked in with the lawyers, but something is going wrong in the country. People are having problems all over with voting. And I just gave him all of the details I had. And I said, there's so much you can do as a campaign and a party. I mean, the government must figure out what, you know, what they can do to stop some of this. And he told me he would get on it. Well, the rest is history.
During the recount process, there were a lot of criticisms that African Americans in Florida were had difficulty voting. And you thought that that was a serious problem that day. But at some point, Al Gore said, it's time to end all talk of the disenfranchisement of black voters in Florida. It's time to stop accusing the Republicans of racism. Did you agree with him that it was time to stop that?
With all due respect, I did not. And let me tell you why. It is, for me, a fundamental issue of fairness. It's a fundamental issue of our democracy. Lyndon Johnson, when he signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, he said that voting was the lifeblood of our democracy. By denying one person the right to vote, we have destroyed our own brand of democracy. And so in my judgment, we were right to pursue these allegations of voter harassment, voter intimidation, voter suppression. We were right to pursue, and I wish we would have pursued more vigorously, the allegations of off-duty policemen stopping people for routine traffic violations right before you get to a precinct. We were right to do that. It had nothing to do with race. It had everything to do with our democracy. The fact that there was a disproportionate number of African Americans, in my judgment, made me a little bit more angry and pissed off, because I understand, not only as a Southerner, but as an African American, just how long it took. And the price of voting in this country was paid for in full with the blood of so many wonderful heroes and sheroes that we could never repay them if we stop making sure that people can have their votes counted and be able to go to the ballot box without fear of intimidation. So, no, I disagree with Gore. But let me just say this about Al Gore. I know in his heart that this was a very difficult period for him personally, a very difficult period for him professionally, because there were people within the Democratic Party who were calling on Gore to quit and not go as long as we went. So Gore really stayed the course much longer, because there were people basically telling us to shut down.
My guest is Donna Brazile. She managed the presidential campaign of Al Gore in 2000. Her new memoir is called Cooking with Grease. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Donna Brazile. She was the campaign manager for Al Gore during his presidential bid in 2000. Now she's written a memoir called Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. The 2000 election was very difficult for you. What was the difficulty of re-entering regular life after this just high-powered, incredible drama that you lived through?
That was very personal. I have spent my entire life on the campaign trail. So to all of a sudden have it end, the way it ended in Florida, it was a shock. I mean, there's nothing you can do. I mean, the only therapy that I could even come to think of, I went to Hawaii. I talk about in the book, I just sat there and looked at the ocean and wished that Jonah and the whale would just come and take me up. I was just out of my body was aching. I was tired. I was emotionally drained, spiritually challenged. And, you know, from time to time, Gore would send me an email because he was like, he was still the vice president of the United States. I'm like, whoo, chill. I couldn't imagine going on. I wanted to just stop. I wanted to move to another country. I couldn't even go back to Washington, D.C. until after the inaugural. I didn't want to see all of those Texans. And so I spent months just trying to get my body healed and get my mind in the right place. And I made a decision that I you know what, I'm finished. This is it. I mean, I need to do something else with my life. And I went up to Harvard, and all of a sudden, these kids, these amazing kids, every day would come to my class or my office, sit down and say, "How'd you get started?" And I'm like, "Huh? What did you do?" And I started recalling my childhood and my first campaign, and all of a sudden that passion just got right back, and I got stirred up again. I'm like, okay, I guess I got to keep going.
But I notice you're not managing a campaign. You're not working on a campaign. You're working in the Voting Rights Institute. You know, you wrote a political memoir. You're on TV a lot talking about politics. Is it intentional that you're not working, say, for Kerry? Do you not want to get back into actually working in a campaign?
Let me just tell you, I am probably one of the most competitive, focused, disciplined political operatives that you've ever produced in this country. I know I am. It's in my bloodstream. I've been doing it since I was 9 years old, and I love it. I love it. The only thing that could bring me joy right now is to see George Bush out of the White House in 2004. That actually would bring me some sense of joy because— in my judgment, he should not be there. That's just as simple as it is. Now, when you feel that kind of passion and you can stir up so much, I mean, I can stir up a thunderstorm just thinking about what I want to do, right? You just have to chill out. You have to, like, okay, let the other people, it's their turn, give them an opportunity to do things their way. And you know what? It's like 2002. I was sitting on the sideline. I was in my garden, minding my own business. And my old home state senator called me, Mary Landrieu, and she said, "They're spending $22 million to take me out." I said, "I'll be home on Southwest in a couple of hours. If John Kerry needs me, I'm ready." But right now, he has a good team on the field. He's leading them in the polls. I believe that John Kerry's going to win this thing. But if he needs a couple of hands, I'm there.
You say that after the recall was over and the Democrats lost, and you were at a terrible point in your life, one of the people who called you to see how you were doing was Karl Rove, who is now President Bush's chief political strategist and has worked very closely with George W. Bush throughout his political career. You say you've come to respect Karl Rove. I find it's interesting that you, who are both on such distant places on the political scale, should that you have warm feelings toward each other, or at least that's how
I know.
It seems.
Isn't that
from
sad?
The book.
I know. You know what? And God, I have a desk full of letters. Let me tell you what it's like when you get involved as a young kid in politics, and you spend all your life reading about every presidential campaign, knowing every precinct, every turnout number, and all of a sudden, you wake up one day and you meet this guy from the other side of the street, and you say, "Oh my God, where did he come from?" And I sat there one day, Claire Shipman actually introduced us. We were having a dinner up in New Hampshire, of all places, in 2000, and I started talking to Carl, and I'm like, "Freak, he goes back as long as I go back at all these presidential campaigns." And so, you know, we talk about sometimes, we talk about, you know, non-voters, we talk about invisible citizens. We have our own little relationship that has nothing to do with his boss being reelected or my best friend being elected. We talk about politics outside of the what I call the partisan nature. We talk about voter participation, and then we talk about our family. So Carl knows if he go up against one of my friends, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to beat him. And he also understands that when it comes to voting in this country, that is one issue I'm not going to allow him to dominate. As long as he doesn't get in my turf wars, I won't get in his turf wars, and we're okay.
One of the big controversies now is whether Catholic politicians who support a woman's right to have an abortion, and this includes John Kerry, should be allowed to receive communion. Some bishops say they should not. You're Catholic, and you've had to decide where you stand on the issue of abortion. You write in your memoir that this first came up for you when you were working with Jesse Jackson on his presidential primary campaign, and now the National Organization for Women wanted you to convince him to come out pro-choice. You weren't sure what to do or even where you stood. You say you called your mother to talk it over with her. Why did you call her, and did that help?
Well, it didn't help. I called my mom because we had the kind of relationship where we can talk about just about anything. And I grew up in a very strict Catholic household. My mom was Baptist, but my father raised us. He was a strict Catholic. I mean, I'm talking about down to what the Pope said last week. He would quote it every week. And of course, we had all of these statues. I knew all about the saints. I mean, I still taught the St. Jude most of the time. And my parents sort of taught me to be a free spirit at the same time to respect the church. And on this matter of public policy, once I got into the issue and consulted with Mary Frances Berry and Eleanor Holmes Norton, I understood that this was an issue of conscience, an issue of public policy, and not an issue of religion. And so the way in which I saw it, the issue, and the way I continue to see the issue is that it's an expression of our faith to understand that we are givers of life, and we can choose life, but we can also choose life in consultation with God. And I would hope that I'm able to continue to take communion and to continue to worship at my church. But also, as a matter of conscience, I am not about to change my views on important public policy issues because my bishops or my archbishops or my priests or whoever say I should think one way. That is not what the Bible teaches you, and I don't want to get into scripture, but that is not what I learned sitting in church.
Donna Brazile will be back in the second half of the show. Her new memoir is called Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, getting fired from the Dukakis campaign. We continue our conversation with political strategist Donna Brazile. Also, poet and playwright Sarah Jones. In her one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel, she plays the parts of immigrants from around the world reading their work at a poetry slam. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Donna Brazil. She was the campaign manager for the Gore Lieberman ticket in 2000. Brazil is the first African-American woman to manage a major presidential campaign. After the Florida recount, she became the first chair of the Democratic National Committee's Voting Rights Institute. In her new memoir, Cooking with Grease, she writes about her experiences in the campaigns of Gore, Michael Dukakis, Walter Mondale, and Jesse Jackson. Now, you work for the Dukakis campaign against the first President Bush, and you got fired from the Dukakis campaign after saying something to the press that was considered inappropriate. Do you want to say what it is that you said?
Oh, yeah. I was in one of my rare moments as a 20-something-year-old. I talked about it in a chapter called Melting Pot. It was rumors circulating all over town and, of course, all over the press bus, and the press wanted to come and talk to me about Dukakis and his relationship with Jackson and blacks and others. And I said, why don't you all go and figure out these rumors? And they said, well, what rumors are you talking about? Well, it was all over. The Washington Post was supposed to break a story. Dan Rather was supposed to discuss it. So I went ahead and talked about the rumors of President Bush 41 infidelity, so-called infidelity, those rumors. And that got me in a lot of hot water with Susan Estrich, and she called me at 5:15. I was fired right here in beautiful New York City at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The worst part was calling my mom to tell her what I did, and she said, what, is that all? My mother, who'd never been fired, worked all her life, just was shocked that, you know, I got fired for, you know, basically quoting rumors.
Let me quote what you said. This is how you quoted in the book. You told the press, why don't you ask George Bush if he intends to take Barbara to the White House? You know, they talk about family values. They talk about all these family issues. But tonight on CBS News, no one is going to report that George Bush has a mistress. Looking back, do you think you said the wrong thing?
Well, at the time, yes. I was not on message that the campaign didn't want, yes, it was bad. It was not appropriate under the circumstances. I was working for a presidential candidate, and that was not my role to talk about that.
I'm always interested in how it's handled when somebody is fired, but it's going to be couched in public terms as a resignation. You were basically told, you said, if you want to fire me, write the press release. And they did. The press release was written for you, in which you said something, you were quoted as saying something like, that the campaign is too important. You didn't want your story to distract from the real message of the campaign. What was it like for you to have it handled that way, to have the press release for your, quote, resignation written by somebody else and then leave?
Well, under the circumstances, Susan Estrich, who's a friend, came down on me so hard, and I talked a little bit about that in the book. I mean, after I had basically saved them so many times, she came down on me so hard, I'm like, you know, I'm not going to sit here and fight and gravel for to stay on board the campaign. I figured, you know, cut it loose, let it go, cry later, but just go, just move on, so that the campaign could go forward. And I did that. I stepped aside, but I said one thing, I am not going to sit here and pretend that I'm going to write the press release, because that is demeaning. That's like putting salt on my wound. I was already wounded, but Jesus, I'm like, let me go. Let me just move forward, and you write the release. And I snuck out the back door and went to Ruthie Goldmont's house and had a nice cocktail before I called my mother.
Okay, something else controversial that you said, and this was to the Washington Post when you had started work on Al Gore's presidential campaign. And you said, I'm in the white boys' world now, and I've got to beat them just to get a seat at the table, but I'm ready for them. I can deal with them. You say by the end of the week you were being called a racist.
Yeah.
Looking back on that, what did you do wrong?
Oh,
did you do something wrong? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Stuart Taylor sent me the longest memo, and then, of course, he published his lengthy column explaining why I should not use the word white boy. Now, of course, white women use the word white boy. That's where I picked it up. But he said, but would you use black boy? And could we use black boy? And as I read that column, I said, okay, I get it. I figured it out. But by the time I figured it out And what my offense was, before I could get to my quote-unquote apology phase, I was branded as a racist. Because I'm in the South most of the time, and they'd turn around my statement saying, I got to beat the white boy. I'm like, hello, Al Gore's a white man. Why you think, you know? So it got all turned around, and it became this mantra. And so it led, I believe, eventually to some of the death threats, because all over these NASCAR-sounding radio stations and mailings, people were like, she gonna beat the white boy. She gonna beat the white boy. You gotta beat her first. And I'm like, oh, I'm in the South. Girlfriend, do not want to get beaten. My people have gone through that. I am beyond the beaten phase. I'm beyond that other stuff. But it really taught me a valuable lesson about race in American politics and how you have to really navigate it with some finesse, because there are so many tripwires, so many third rails when you discuss race in American politics, and they still exist today. We have not had a dialogue, a kind of conversation that Bill Clinton talked about back when he was president, that will allow us to move beyond just having a talk about race, but more a dialogue. We are still behind the curve on racism in America.
Former President Clinton is coming out with his memoir at the end of this month. So that will mean he will be making the rounds, doing a lot of speeches and interviews and so on. What role would you like to see Bill Clinton play in this presidential campaign? During the Al Gore campaign, there was a lot of friction between the two, and President Clinton's role was pretty low-key in that, I think, at Al Gore's request.
Well, Bill Clinton, you got to understand from Al Gore's vantage point, Al Gore was not seen as a quote-unquote leader. He was seen as a vice president, which I guess many Americans think you're a follower. You follow the president. And so we needed to establish Al Gore's credentials as a strong, decisive leader. He didn't reach that phase in the campaign, actually, until after he selected Joe Lieberman. But in battleground states, you essentially poll, you get a pulse, and you say, okay, where can I put Bill Clinton so that he can maximize Gore's advantage? And we select a state where Clinton would maximize Gore's advantage. Now, I think John Kerry will have to do the same thing. Bill Clinton is larger than life. He is, as my little sisters and brothers will say, he is all of that and a pack of gum, because he is refreshing. The man is just juicy in terms of his dialogue, his ability to communicate, his ability to establish rapport with people. He communicates like Ronald Reagan at the heart level, where people really understand what you're talking about. He don't speak in babble speak, double talk. He's good. I mean, I'm going to say that because I spent 8 years supporting Bill Clinton, knowing Bill Clinton, you know, respecting Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is fabulous. And I hope that Kerry use him strategically, politically, but more importantly, to help persuade people to get out to vote as well as get them out to the polls. Because Bill Clinton really connects with people at a level that I wish more political leaders could.
One of the things...
That's my personal view, of course. I know my party will disagree with me, but I am a Clinton fan, a major fan of the Clintons, both Bill and Hillary. They are value-added. They raise money for the party. In every electoral season that I've been involved in for the last 10 years, I have called on the Clintons, Hillary or Bill, whoever's available, and said, help me, and they were there to help. They are good people, and God bless them.
One of the things that you've worked on throughout your political career is getting out the African-American vote. And you say even when you were in college, you were really frustrated with fellow African American students when they didn't vote, even when they didn't vote for like, you know, student elections. What are some of the unique aspects of getting out the black vote?
Well, it's a vote that is a young vote. It's not young in age, but young in spirit. Remember, African Americans have only been voting now for about 38 years, so it's a generation that did not struggle for the right to vote. They take their vote for granted. They don't understand that it's important to turn on the power. And the only way you can turn on the power in American politics is by voting. And so I have worked all my life to perfect how do you communicate, how do you message, how do you persuade African-Americans and other Americans too, but African-Americans to turn out as if their lives depended on it. We're not the potatoes in American politics. We're the gravy. So therefore, we have to spread longer and we have to provide the margin of victory in those close races where our vote will matter. And that's what I try to persuade them. By voting, you change America. You know, I have to say this, more Americans tuned in and voted for Reuben and Clay and now Fantasia and Diana.
They could vote many times.
That's right. Well, just like buying a book, you can go to cash register and buy it as many times as you want. But when it comes to voting in American politics, what can Reuben, Diane, or Fantasia, Diana do for your health care? What can they do to lower your college tuition? I know some politicians who can do something about that, and that's the connection that we have to make in this political season.
Donna Brazile, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Donna Brazile's new memoir is called Cooking with Grease. Coming up, Sarah Jones performs an excerpt of her Obie Award-winning show, Bridge and Tunnel. This is Fresh Air. Sarah Jones is one of the stars of spoken word performance. Her latest one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel, is set at an open mic poetry slam. She portrays immigrants from Pakistan, Jamaica, Mexico, Jordan, and other countries who have come to the Bridge and Tunnel Cafe in South Queens, New York, for the annual event called I Am a Poet Too. In the New York Times review of the show, Margot Jefferson wrote, "Solo performance frees gifted artists to change sex, race, age, body type, and personality in an instant. It takes great craft and generosity. Sarah Jones has both," unquote. Jones's fans include Meryl Streep, who is billed as the co-presenter of the show. Last month, Bridge and Tunnel won an Obie, an Off-Broadway Theater Award, for outstanding solo performance. We invited Jones for an interview. I asked her to introduce us to one of the characters from Bridge and Tunnel, so here she is as Gladys, a Jamaican immigrant.
My name is Gladys, and I'm a poet, slash performer, slash playwright, slash spoken word artist, slash actress. But I currently still have my regular job. And there are basically few career possibilities for people of Jamaican ancestry in this country. One is to become Secretary of State. So you have Secretary of State. Another is to take care of children. But you see, either way is the same thing. Because you have to run behind the overprivileged baby who can barely form sentences. And then you see, you must clean up his messes for him while he takes a nap. But I don't like to mix art and politics.
That's great. And Sarah, how did you think of Gladys?
I think Gladys comes from my experience with meeting wonderful poets, you know, writers of various disciplines, other kinds of artists from lots of different backgrounds, including, you know, people from the Caribbean who are such a vibrant part of the cultural community, either here in New York or wherever I've traveled, yet I don't hear their voices, you know, when I turn on my television or I, you know, go to see a movie. The most you can expect is, you know, a stereotype of a Rasta who, you know, isn't recognizable as any human being who we could ever be friends with or want to talk to or anything. It's always, you know, kind of just a caricature for the sake of the movie or, you know, backdrop or something. And I thought, what a waste of, you know, the voices of people who really have often, you know, compelling things to say and unique takes on the world. And, you know, what are those stories of coming over here wanting to find opportunity maybe as an artist or as a worker and discovering that, you know, it's very difficult to get a job. You know, your educational achievements don't mean the same thing here in this country as they do in your country. And so you do find yourself having to do work that, you know, maybe doesn't pay as well or is, you know, kind of restricts you to a certain field. Who are all of these people with these accents who are doing all this work in this country, often for very little money, you know, or without the kind of, you know, respect for their dignity that should come with that work. So I kind of want to hear them. I want to hear what they have to say.
Now, along with creating these characters, you've created poems for many of them to read, because after all, it is a poetry slam. And some of the poems are pretty funny, unintentionally funny in the sense that I don't think the characters would necessarily think they're funny.
Right.
Have you written any poems that you intended to do in your own voice that you then realized, man, this really isn't very good, and then you used it in the voice of another character?
I absolutely have done that. I think sometimes those characters, you know, the ones that I've been able to flesh out as fully as I need to have them come to life on stage, and, you know, be recognizable people for the audience, those characters are often, you know, the voice I hear in my head as I sit down to write something. So if I'm not careful, I'll be writing from the perspective of, say, there's a character in the show, Lorraine, who's the oldest immigrant in the show. She was really little when she came to this country, and, well, I'll let her tell it. But
hi, how are you, Jerry? Honey, how are you? This is Lorraine. Listen, let me tell you what happens, you know, when Sarah Jones, a very nice young girl, you know, a young black girl, she calls herself black. She's really more like a caramel color, if you see her. But anyway, so she writes these poems, you know, and she writes them sometimes thinking like she's another person. And sometimes, you know, you really have to write what you know. And I tell her, you know, listen, try to put yourself in that person's head. But it sounds ridiculous for her to try to read, you know, about me and my experience coming over here. You know, if you came through Ellis Island, I said, you know, let me read that. That's a poem that comes from Lorraine's experience. So to make it complete for the audience, it's better for me to read it. You see what I mean, honey? So that's the idea.
That's really great. Do you want to do a couple of lines of the poem?
Well, you know, my poem has more to do with, you know, I'm not as young as I used to be. And I can't see you, Terry, but don't give me that look. I'm not that old. Okay. Anyway, the point is that as an older person in this society, and I know we don't talk about it, but people don't have the respect. Once you start to get older, you know, there's what you call ageism. They think you're too old, and they just want to make fun. And it's a shame. So I have a parody, a send-up, you see, because the young kids, they think, you know, that once there's a little snow on the roof, as they say, even though mine's strawberry blonde, I don't let it go white. But anyway, the point is that, you know, they think that you're not sharp. You don't, you're not a vibrant person anymore. And I want them to realize that everybody was young once, and when you get older, you know, you still carry all of that experience with you. So here's a little piece of a poem and for all of the young kids that I see when I travel on the bus. Riding on the bus. No, really, please, don't get up. I don't make a fuss. No, really, please, don't get up. I have the senior's blues. No, really, please, don't get up. I will step on your foot with my orthopedic shoes. And so on. I like to do that one. It's a hit with the kids. And then they can remember one of these days they'll be trying on a pair of their own orthopedic shoes.
My guest is Sarah Jones. She's performing her one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel, off-Broadway. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sarah Jones. Her current one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel, is set at an open-mic poetry slam. She portrays immigrants from around the world who've come to read their work. Jones grew up in New York and Washington in an interracial family. Now, you have such an ear for voices. I know that when you were in high school, you went to the UN International School, where I imagine you met students from all over the world. Did that help establish the music of different voices and accents in your mind?
I definitely think my experience at the United Nations School solidified what had begun when I was much younger. I think being in a family and kind of school environments from a very young age that provided me with a lot of multicultural fodder, for lack of a better way to put it. I mean, I did have this mix of voices, you know, at the Thanksgiving table and at you know, school picnics or whatever that was. There were lots of different accents to kind of savor. And then TV and movies, and I mean, it just all really opened up even more for me. I started hearing the distinctions. I mean, I think I tried out a British accent for a school play in like the fourth grade. I think we did As You Like It or something, and I came out, you know, I came out with this accent, and my teacher sort of looked at me like, where did this working class kid in D.C. get this British accent from, you know? But I guess I just was fascinated and really taken with the sounds of these voices really early, probably the same way other kids get into, you know, video games or playing outside or whatever it is that kids can really get passionate about. For me, it was all these voices. And the UN school, where suddenly I could hear all of these frequencies, you know, all of these new voices, it just I was overstimulated every day, all day. It was amazing.
Now, I don't know anything about the UN school, except that I would assume that the parents of the children in it worked for the UN, which your parents did not. So what?
Right.
How do you get in? What is it?
Well, there are some kids whose families don't work for the UN. You just sort of find out about the school, as my parents did. I know my parents were really committed to making sure I had a continuing multicultural, you know, educational environment when I got to New York from Washington, D.C. So they probably didn't look around and realize that every school in New York is multicultural unless it's private a way that, you know, some kids can't go. But
was it so important to them to have a multicultural school environment for you because you're from a multicultural family in the sense that your father's side of the family is African-American, your mother's side is... I'm not sure where your mother's from.
Hodgepodge.
Hodgepodge.
Hodgepodge. No, she's my father's side of the family is African American and of there's some Caribbean descent way back there. And then on my mother's side of the family, there's a mix. My grandmother was Irish and German, and my grandfather is a mix of stuff that includes, I mean, the roots go to the Caribbean, to Dominican Republic. There's a whole mix of what, you know, kind of creates this funny thing that is me. But yes, I think that they're coming from, you know, this multiracial and multicultural sort of melting pot under one roof meant that they had more of a commitment to making sure when I looked around and talked to the kids around me, it wasn't such a strange thing to come home and see my family because their families looked similar. I mean, it was nothing for us to, you know, kind of sit around in class and, hi, my mom's from Egypt and my father's from Sweden. Oh, well, my dad's Korean and, you know, my mother's from Sri Lanka. I mean, it was just normal.
So when you were at the UN school and hearing students from all around the world with different accents and so on, and you were really excited and started to do their voices, like, what was your stage for that? You weren't performing your one-man show yet, you know, and if you did it to their faces, it would seem like you were making fun of them. So like how would you
funny. I'd love to be able to tell you that I would clear the tables in the cafeteria and hop up there and start performing, but it certainly wasn't quite like that. I I mean, the excitement that I describe in hearing all of those voices is something that I think I was only partially aware of at the time. I knew that, you know, I was surrounded by all of these wonderful languages, accents, but I also knew that I had to get my butt to math class on time and I had to, you know, get my homework done. So I think that what was happening more than anything was there was this kind of, you know, series of germinating seeds that were planted in my head at the time. And the only times I really got to start to, you know, experiment with my ability to repeat those voices back to people was on a few occasions. I can't believe I didn't get in trouble for this then, and hopefully I won't get in trouble for it now. But I used to get classmates out of different courses if they didn't want to have to go, or some of us would skip the day once in a while, and I would
call up and say, hello, this is Renata's mother. Could you please tell her to meet me down in the car park because she's feeling very ill and she'll have to come home. I'm sorry about that. Could you please send her along home?
And I'd do things like that from the payphone at school. It was terrible.
Wait, were you ever discovered?
We didn't have cell phones. I was not discovered, but hopefully all of my classmates are now safely not living at home and won't suffer any consequences because I'm outing them.
What would you get in return? Would there be a payoff for doing that?
No payoff. Lots of giggles. Uh-huh. Lots of giggles, and we'd go, you know, hang out and terrorize New York City for an afternoon.
Sarah Jones, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Take care.
Sarah Jones will perform her one-woman show, Bridge and Tunnel, off-Broadway through August 15th. She hopes to bring the show to Broadway next year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio. When you call an 800 number for customer service, the person on the other end might actually be in India, where many American jobs have been outsourced. On the next Fresh Air, Tom Friedman discusses his new Discovery Channel documentary about the other side of outsourcing. And we'll talk about his latest foreign affairs columns in the New York Times. Join us for the next Fresh Air.